The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and enter the offer code Guardian to get 20% off throughout the month of September. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Football Weekly today, Manchester Derby, Man City merciless, United Van Persieless, as Pellegrini Machini destroys Moyes' boys. Never mind, as Wayne said, it's not that big a fixture for them. Elsewhere, Arsenal top, Liverpool totter, Tottenham and Toffees roll on. Di Canio departs at Sunderland's Black Cats. Can Di Canio? We salute him, but not in that way. Abroad, Dortmund in crisis. Klopp's side dropping points. Penalty kicks in crisis as Balotelli misses one. Llorente lives. Real beat Getafe without their taffy. Napoli and PSG Monaco and more. Plus posts and tweets in this Football Weekly. Wow, it's a busy pod. So much to talk about and so many people to do that talking. Cause we've got Philippe Auclair.
Bonjour, Timbo.
Bonjour, Philippe. Simon Burnton.
Bonjour.
All right, yeah, very nicely done.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and also Barry Glendening.
Bonjour, Jimbo.
Oui, ça va, Barry?
Ça va bien, merci.
Bon. And also, in a special nostalgia tribute, Sean Ingle.
Hello, James.
Your first pod in 7 years, we think.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, back in the day, we were in a cupboard in Farringdon. Do you remember that?
We were. There was no heat. There was no air conditioning. There was nothing. It was a sweatshop, literally.
Literally a sweatshop. God. And out of those humble beginnings, this global media empire has been born. I'm joking, but in a way not, because Barry, you're on the telly now, aren't you? As well as radio.
Yeah.
You're cross-media.
I'm just a shameless media slot.
Hey!
I'm on your manor tonight, actually, in BT Sport.
My manor. I think you're probably on it more than I am, actually. That's enough of media backslapping. Let's talk to ITV's Philippe Auclair about the Manchester derby. Philippe, did you see this?
Of course I saw
it. What happened?
They got beaten 4-1.
Right. Okay.
They got humiliated 4-1. Why did they get beat 4-1? Because there was no shape, no sense in that United team, because Manchester City played very well, because Ashley Young is crap, because... I don't know. I mean, I don't know what to say. I was shell-shocked like everybody else. I couldn't quite believe actually what I was saying for the first 40, 45 minutes or so.
I wouldn't say I was shell-shocked. I think that Manchester United's team is not as good as Manchester City's team. And if City play to their potential, then Manchester United will be slain. Mm. And so they were. City were awesome, kind of back to front. Company was... incredible. It was a phenomenal defensive performance from him. Manchester United have a commendable policy of promoting English talent where possible. And you look at the likes of Ashley Young, Smalling, cleverly coming off the bench. These are good players. Players good enough to play active roles in a team that is going to come second or third.
But this still doesn't explain how Manchester City is able to dominate, slaughter Manchester United, this team which has got these fine players who might not quite make the grade, in even more emphatic a fashion than they did against Newcastle. That doesn't explain that. You know, it's not the personnel that explains that. The tactics, I mean, you could say, I mean, the midfield was basically the space. You could define it, the midfield is a space occupied by Manchester City players and where Manchester United players are not.
There was a listlessness there. You know, one thing you can always say about David Moyes' teams at Everton, they were perhaps never the most pretty to watch, but they always were kind of dogged. There was some dog in them. There wasn't really much there, certainly for the first...
It was a poodle. If there
minutes.
Was a dog, it was a poodle.
Right. Barney Roney, in his article today, calling United a team sent out to stifle, but one that worryingly had no response when City refused to show the same caution that Chelsea had shown in their game with Man United. Is that a fair reading of...
It is. He also equated them to Roy Hodgson's England, which was perhaps slightly harsh. But the point that, you know, they went out as a 4-4-2, they set out to stifle, there wasn't really much energy going forward, certainly for the last, until the last 20 minutes or so. I thought he might have changed things at half-time and didn't either.
All right. There are those who suggest that this result was coming and that the presence of Van Persie had pretty much been masking these problems, say, in the Swansea game, for example, when they did struggle for the first half-hour and then he sorted it out for them. And the first time he goes out of the lineup, bingo, the whole house of cards comes a-crashing down.
One thing that surprises me, when you saw Manchester United against Bayer Leverkusen, against, okay, a team that is probably not the most solid defensively speaking in the Bundesliga, where there are not many solid defensively teams, you saw something that could be perhaps a promise of a new Manchester United in terms of integrating Kagawa in particular, because Fellaini and Carrick and Kagawa, that worked really well, actually. And I was flabbergasted when I saw that Kagawa was not in the starting lineup. I was flabbergasted when he didn't come up at halftime. And I was flabbergasted when Tom Cleverley went in and not Shinji Kagawa, because there was such a lack of pressure up front. There was such a lack of inventivity that basically, yes, we all commend Manchester City's performance, but where was the pressure?
Barry?
Well, I think David Moyes' default setting when Everton were playing big teams was caution, and that was a criticism that was levelled at him by a lot of Everton fans who were sort of getting tired of it towards the end of his reign. And his refusal to pick Kagawa is mystifying at this stage.
What did you make of his post-match comments about the fixture computer again?
Well, it's nonsense, isn't it? Paranoid idiocy. And he's not doing himself any favours making comments like that, because it just sounds foolish.
But when we say that he was cautious, I do remember Everton drawing 4-4 against Manchester United. That was not exactly a cautious performance. And there were signs last year with Everton that he was really trying to make them play a far more expansive game, and that he was not afraid to, quote-unquote, have a go. I'm not so sure. I mean, the level of performance of these players was so below what you would normally expect that, yes, you can praise City. By the way, you were talking about 4-4-2. City are playing a kind of 4-4-2. It's a kind of 4-2-2-2, you know, with the wide men, with Navas and Nasri going to the wings. But you have two front men who come by the way, absolutely magnificently. So I'm not too sure if this, tactically speaking, or if it's just something that went wrong in their brains rather than in their feet, so to speak.
One of the surprises was maybe the City hitting this kind of form, company coming back, a massive factor, was it? Because until now they'd really struggled against less fancied opponents.
Yeah, but perhaps there are motivational issues. Certainly there was no questioning the work rate of their players yesterday. Mm. Company, his absence is very keenly felt. He is a phenomenal defender. I mean, one thing you notice about defenders is where their clearances fall. A lot of defenders can heave the ball out of defence, but if they can clear the ball straight to a teammate, then they can be a kind of creative force. They can launch counterattacks. And the number of times he sent blind clearances, apparently blind clearances, to the feet of a teammate was, well, too much to be coincidence. And it was an incredibly measured performance from him. I think it did kind of stem from the back.
Hmm. I mean, I think it's worth pointing out, I mean, City were brilliant yesterday. I mean, I loved the way Aguero and Negredo linked together. Negredo looks like he's come fresh out of a bar until 5 a.m. in Bilbao or somewhere like that, and yet he's very masculine, very energetic. But at the same time, it may be a danger that we're taking this game in isolation, making too much of it. Remember when City beat United 6-1, the title race still went to that very last game of the season. City only won it right in the last minute. Yes, United haven't been impressive, but last week City weren't very impressive against Stoke, and we were questioning what they were doing. So I think we've got to be slightly careful we don't jump too many guns.
I read again the report of the 1989 5-1 game, which was published in The Guardian at the time, and there was this extraordinary quote by Alex Ferguson talking about his defence, the defensive performance of his team. He said it was like climbing a glass mountain.
What did he mean by that?
That basically they had absolutely nothing to... He didn't have a grip on absolutely anything. His defence was all over the place. It was a disastrous performance. And at the time, people were calling him names that they're now calling David Moyes. Mm. And the difference is that the patience says there's no patience these days whatsoever.
Right. Were they calling him David then?
Yes, that's very funny. Just to bring some grist to Sean's mill.
It's a fair point, because Fergie, you know, lost this colossal derby a couple of years ago, and now Moyes has done it. But a lot of people are saying this is a worse result, even though that was a bigger scoreline. Because in that game, United only had 10 men for a large part of
Jenny
it.
Jenny Evans sent off 47th minute.
And it was pretty close. Well, it was 3-1 until, the 89th minute, and then it all fell apart. But still, eh?
I do agree that the fixture list, well, I don't think it's a conspiracy against United, but the fixture list hasn't been kind to Moyes, and he's had these very stern tests and failed quite a few of them.
And next up in the League Cup, it's Liverpool.
Yes, with a certain Mr. Luis Suarez making his return from suspension, the naughty step, and obviously there's going to be a huge focus on that game because of that. So it's difficult to see Moyes putting out a sort of second string team, because I think it's a game he really needs to win.
Mm, absolutely. He can't be snobbish about any competition, can he?
No.
No, absolutely not. What do you think? Will Suarez play?
I expect he will, yeah.
Right. Because Liverpool just been knocked off the top of the Premier League by Southampton at Anfield, and a real step backwards for a Brendan Rodgers side, Philippe.
And a step forward for Southampton.
That's a very fair point.
To whom we gave love about a month ago, and yeah. I think we can do that again.
Okay.
They were terrific.
Yeah.
Because many people, I mean, it's true that the idea that he started with four centre-backs was rather odd. But what was even odder, Brendan Rodgers.
Oh, yeah.
What was even odder is that... when I saw that, I thought, well, Kolo Touré on the right sort of makes sense. He's played in that position before, and he was actually very good in that role for Arsenal. And I thought at the beginning, oh, he's playing Daniel Agger on the left. That makes complete sense to me. And I realized, no, it's Mamadou Sakho. Oh, my God. which, and that's inviting trouble. And, of course, the absence of Coutinho is a huge, huge problem for them.
A view on Sakho, because one or two people who've watched him in...
he's a terrific player.
Oh, you think he's a terrific
I think he's a terrific central defender.
Okay.
They probably paid too much money for him because he was in last year of his contract. There's also the problem that Sakho really had a very close link with PSG and didn't really want to go, so it will be more difficult for him.
He was back at PSG.
Yeah, he was in tears talking. He was making his farewell to the Parc des Princes, and he said, you know, my story with PSG is not over. And it was not, believe me, words that meant nothing.
Mm.
But he has all the qualities to be a very fine centre-back, particularly in the Premier League. I have no doubt about that. You can't judge a player who's like this on two performances. One, when he has hardly played. The second, when he's played out of position.
Mm.
It's ridiculous.
No. The criticism was more based on perhaps performances previously in league.
I love the story about him breaking gym equipment that was around a couple of days ago. They had done a strength test on him in the Liverpool gym, and he had bust the kit because he was just too strong.
Wow.
Yeah. And he's been banned from using it because he's just too good for it.
Is there a sort of a big fairground hammer thing at Liverpool's fairground then?
I don't know the details.
Right. So, from Liverpool's point of view, a little bit of a blip, this one, or something more worrying, the Coutinho absence, is that something that's going
to
be...
It's very hard to tell, you know. I mean, we were only five games into the season, and everybody's beating everybody. I can't remember the last time when you had only one unbeaten team after five rounds, and also where you have, how many is that, 17th within 4 points, something like this, after five games. It's pretty unusual. I'm not... unduly worried. I think it's one of those Rodgers experiments that went wrong. He's had a few of those in the past, but we shouldn't, you know, that performance. And again, we should up the performance by Southampton. The way, I mean, Pochettino is making that team play and work is remarkable. It's also very pleasing in the eye. It's lovely to see Adam Lallana coming back to what he can be. It's lovely to see Luke Shaw being, you know, asserting himself like he does. You know, it's been very well built, that team, and it's absolute pleasure to watch.
Right, Pochettino putting on a little bit of weight, and just on the side, and
like Brendan Rodgers.
No, but one of our posters pointed out he looks a bit like Sam out of Lord of the Rings now. Actually, which, well, that's the end of that bit, and next bit up next features Everton, the only unbeaten team. I think I'm right, isn't that right?
Correct.
Yeah, good. And Arsenal and Chelsea and all that stuff. London clubs, ahoy. Well, we're talking about Arsenal, Chelsea, Spurs in a little bit. First, though, Sunderland losing 3-0 against West Brom. And, of course, the subsequent departure of Paolo Di Canio. Sunderland fandom's Barry Glendinning now speaks. Barry.
Yeah, who could possibly have seen this coming? That Paolo Di Canio would leave after a row with his players.
Right.
He's been criticising them heavily since he took over, often in public. They don't like that. Some of the criticism was merited, but in fact quite a lot of it was, but there's only so often you can criticise players like that in public before they will turn on you, and that's what they did yesterday. And at the training ground, and he was sacked as a result. Strangely, a West Brom supporting mate of mine has reminded me last night what a Jonah West Brom are. Chris Hughton, Mick McCarthy, Roberto Di Matteo, Andre Villas-Boas, Paolo Di Canio and John Gregory have all lost their jobs after their sides were beaten by West Brom.
Wow, they're like the woman in black, aren't they? Or watching that video in Ring.
Yeah.
Crikey. And there's now a Twitter campaign for you and Jonathan Wilson to take over the reins. Yeah, how's that going?
I think Jonathan Wilson would be an excellent manager. Mm. He looks like a manager. I can picture him, you know, a suit, tie, sort of undone, leaning against the dugout, sort of gazing into the middle distance while he chews gum and, you know, see the cogs turning in his head. And he probably couldn't make much of a more of a pig's ear of it than Di Canio has.
Right. Although, you know, people are regarding this as a bit of a disaster for Sunderland, but in actual fact, they were heading for relegation. They brought Di Canio in and he kept them up.
I disagree with that. I think that's one of the great myths. O'Neill had 31 points from 31 games last year.
Right.
Di Canio comes in and gets eight points from seven games.
So two wins out of his first three.
Two wins and seven. When Di Canio took over, Sunderland was 16th.
Oh.
When he, you know, at the end of the season they were 17th, they only needed 4 points ultimately to stay up in the end. O'Neill would have got those 4 points. I think that's one of the great myths that Di Canio came in and changed everything and sorted out. Sunderland probably would have stayed up regardless.
All right, Sean. Good for you. Good for you.
I don't necessarily agree with the decision to sack him, but it's hard to see how his position was tenable. But now Sunderland have these 14 players he's signed,
most of whom
have no Premier League.
That's one of the great myths, Barry, to be fair, of this whole business. He didn't sign them. The club has signed them, and they'll be there for them and whoever now comes in, for you and Jonathan. And what a baptism of fire you and Jonathan face, because you've got to take on Man United, no, Liverpool next, then Man United.
But their home games would be all right.
All right, yeah. And so, then Swansea away, then the derby with Newcastle in your next four matches. Yikes. What are your plans?
I think we'll be sacked after two games.
All right, well, that's pretty much your game plan going into this, isn't it?
Well, if I get a large payoff, that'll suit me fine, yeah. I'm quite happy to go in, lose two games, get sacked.
With these 14 players and presumably somebody competent in charge, are Sunderland in a good position? Because at the start of the season, Jonathan Wilson was saying it's either going to be a great success or a total disaster. We had the total disaster bit, but are there not the ingredients there to still make this a success this season?
Possibly, but it depends on who replaces him.
Right.
Some of the names I've seen linked with the job are quite worrying. Alex McLeish, Roberto Di Matteo, Tony Pulis, Steve McLaren.
Which one of these names is worrying you most?
All of them.
But these
Gus Poyet is the only name I see.
McLaren did a great job not far away at Middlesbrough.
Great job is pushing.
Yeah, he took them to UEFA Cup.
Absolutely, UEFA Cup final.
Finished 14th about 8 years in a row.
Yeah.
That's better
giddy
than
heights for Sunderland. Had you said, I don't know, Mick McCarthy, I'd understand. But
has Martin O'Neill appeared on that list?
No, I think Martin O'Neill is a certainty for the Ireland job. So.
Ah, okay. All right, well, so at the moment, the smart money's on who? Di Matteo?
It seems to be Di Matteo or Gus Poyet are the names being bandied about.
What Di Canio, he wasn't very good at motivating the players or kind of tactics or public interface. But what he did do is he had phenomenal facial expressions. It is sad for me that his moment of greatest drama was carried out without me being able to see quite what happened to his face in those moments.
You'll always have the post-game at the Hawthorns...
That mime
show.
I know. Ideally, Ellis Short would have come out then and conducted the firing by mime in front of the irate Sunderland fans. That would have been good. That would have been right.
What now for Di Canio, do you think?
I've no idea.
Will he get another job?
Dusting the busts of a few historical figures in his flat?
I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting question, but I imagine that he might take some time off to reflect. I'm not sure who's going to be coming in for him.
BT Sport?
Perhaps so. Perhaps so. They'll employ anyone, as we know. There you go. Well, in other news, Hull got a much-needed win at Newcastle. That was a bit of a surprise for many people, wasn't it? Newcastle coming off successive wins. A lot of love for Huddleston, Barry.
Yeah, well, interestingly, Huddleston's a player Di Canio really, really wanted to bring Sunderland during the summer and failed to get him, but it was his main target. And the way he's playing for Hull makes you think, A, Di Canio has a keen eye for a good player, and B, that if he had gone to Sunderland, then Di Canio might not
be out of a job.
Mm-hmm. All right. Terrific goal from Aluko, of course, in that 3-2 win. Villa beat Norwich. Kozak, curious figure this, enigmatic, top scorer in the Europa League last year at Lazio, but didn't score a single goal in Serie A before Lazio, but he's off the mark there for Villa, and pressure apparently on Houghton. Apparently there were cries if you don't know what you're doing.
The East Anglian natives are getting restless by all accounts.
Okay.
He's a very cautious manager, and it doesn't have a huge amount of charisma, I suppose, which probably doesn't help his cause.
There is a wildly charismatic, currently unemployed manager available to them. They so choose.
Chris Houghton was once described to me by someone in football as a natural number two, which I think he perhaps is. You know, he's good coach rather than manager.
Okay, and Everton with a big 3-2 win at West Ham. Lukaku. Just Lukaku.
I've been banging the drum for him for months, and I think he's a fantastic player. I think Jose Mourinho made a huge mistake farming him out to Everton, and I think Everton have got themselves an absolute diamond there for the season, and I expect him to score lots of goals and do very well for them.
Right, meanwhile, Leighton Baines, has he been watching Ronaldo or something?
Or the opposite. I think you will find that Leighton Baines has got a better conversion rate than Ronaldo.
Actually, I think you'll find that A, I was being ironic, and B, I'm not sure that he does, because I was just reading something this morning.
Shall we just pretend he does?
Okay, let's pretend he does. Anyway, but that was phenomenal stuff from Leighton Baines, wasn't it?
Yes, pretty much so. It was
two for two.
Just curious to know, Lukaku was knocked out cold when he scored his goal and had to be told he'd scored. I mean, if a jockey gets a concussion,
you have a two-week holiday.
Really?
And you have to pass the doctor.
Moments later, he was storming into the penalty area and trying to set up another goal. I'm not entirely sure. It seemed a bit weird to me that he was then saying he had no idea he had scored.
It's a great story, though, isn't it?
His recovery was astonishing.
You did.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, I think if you establish the proof that there is indeed genuine concussion, yes, you will have to let the player rest for a couple of weeks.
Right.
Seems only right. But it's been absolutely magnificent. Mm. I think in many ways, he was one of the many shadows hanging over Stamford Bridge on Saturday. People couldn't quite understand. I don't think the fans understand. I don't think the people who watch the game understand. I don't think anybody understands apart from...
I think Mourinho really needs one of his strikers at Chelsea to really come good this season. Otherwise, that will be the question that's hanging over him. Why on earth did he let Lukaku go?
Yeah. And Roberto Martinez, full of praise for his extraordinary intelligence and inquisitive nature, speaks six or seven languages, according to Martinez. And,
well, I remember after the Reading beat West Brom 3-2 last season at the Medeski, Lukaku was the best player in the field by a mile, scored two goals, and afterwards, when talking to reporters, was just incredibly critical of his own performance, saying that he should have scored more, and it was his fault that West Brom lost.
Hmm. Right, well, we've still got plenty more to talk about this week, including Chelsea, Mourinho, more on that, and the extraordinary events around the rest of Europe. But quick bit of music. Right, London clubs, Crystal Palace losing. And talk about that maybe a little bit with Sid as well, because of Swansea's incredible Valencia win in the Europa League. But Arsenal go top of the pile with their win over Stoke. Spurs get the win at Cardiff, impressively enough. And Chelsea will... Jose Mourinho doing some crowing after this 2-0 win over Fulham, but they were pretty poor until Stockdale's extraordinary bit of goalkeeping, or not goalkeeping.
They were very, very, very poor the first 45 minutes. In fact, Fulham were, I think, the most cultured side. Should have opened the scoring. Obviously, Darren Bent completely scuffed his 1v1 the check. They looked uninspired, they looked cumbersome, leaden. They looked also like players who were always wondering, oh, what should I do now? What have I been told to do? How should I move? Mourinho kept having a go at Hazard and Sherlock, asking them constantly to switch sides and do this and do that. And you can see the players having difficulties really to communicate and to relate to their manager. It was a very, very poor performance. There were actually even a few boos from where next I was sitting, from some Chelsea fans. I didn't hear Jose Mourinho's name being sung out. They were saved, you can say, by the fact that Stockdale, this double mistake, And also that Fulham are a team that have got absolutely no reactive qualities and capacities. Otherwise, a better team would certainly have taken something out of Chelsea. Just as Hull, by the way, if they hadn't been so intimidated, perhaps, as they were in the first half at Stamford Bridge, could have come out with something from that game. It was a very, very poor performance. It was so much worse than what we saw under Rafa Benitez last season. And when you think that with a similar squad that at the time was knackered, had to play something like 69 games during the season, was rotated constantly, and what Rafa Benitez did, which is to win and win with style, and Jose Mourinho still has to prove he can do it. Apart from that, I love him.
Apart from that, okay.
And the fact, of course, that he keeps... that we've got to talk about Juan Mata, because I think, again, if you talk to supporters and fans, I mean, nobody understands what the hell is going on here.
Well, we'll come on to Mata in a second, but I want to salute to John Obi Mikel. No outfield player has made more appearances, this from OptiStats, in the Premier League before scoring their first goal than John Obi Mikel. 185 games.
261, including the...
That's
the other competitions.
If you had a DVD of his career highlights, how long do you think it would be? I mean, he's one of these sort of nowhere men that kind of does a kind of sort of job, but you don't really ever see what he does, do you?
There are goalkeepers who score more than John Obi Mikel.
There must be some big brutish defender that hasn't gone longer without scoring.
Presumably that's not counting people who've never scored.
Right, okay. Yeah.
Anyway, on the subject of Juan Mata, here's Casella with an interesting take on the situation. Hi, James. As a Real Madrid fan, I think the problem between Mata and Mourinho is not about Mata being friend of Real Madrid players. The problem Mata has is that Mu spent around €32 million on Quintrao in his first year at Madrid. Then in 2011, Mata went to Chelsea for only about 20. Since then, the Madrid media have been using Mata as a weapon to attack Mu and his ties with Jorge Mendes. Basically, Mourinho, you blew it because you spent all your money on Mendes-approved players, and that's the play you should have gone for. As a result, if he plays Mata now, in a way, he'll be proving that his critics were right all along. So that's why he's eager to cast Mata as this bloke who, yes, was the player of the year for the last two seasons, but now has to be re-educated about football under some kind of North Korean Mourinho-esque.
And calling him, which I thought was totally unacceptable, that kid, something like that, and... you talk about that, but a guy who is world champion, European champion, has won the Champions League, the Europa League, has been player of the year two seasons running, was probably deserved to be player of the year, footballer of the year in England last year. This is so disrespectful. I get very, very angry when I hear about that. And the thing is that I'm starting to give some credence, and we'll talk to Sid about it, the fact that it so happens that the Spanish players are being, ostracized. Azpilicueta, who had a terrific end to the season, has been put aside. Torres, who was the best goal scorer in Europe, is ignored despite scoring a super goal in the Super Cup. And also, it seems that the players who, for some reason, helped Rafa Benitez last season and who are known to have supported Rafa Benitez are the ones who are on the way out, who are forgotten, like David Luiz as well, who was one of the players who publicly went to support Rafa Benitez.
Are you suggesting that Jose Mourinho is spiteful and petty and prone to holding grudges? Surely not, no.
It's one thing to leave Luis and Mata out of your 11, but to not even have them on the bench does seem particularly pointed.
When they were fit, we can confirm that.
All right. Well, the word is that Mourinho does intend to select Mata, Luis, Azpilicueta, Ryan Bertrand and Michael Essien for the League Cup match, and possibly also, dramatically, Fernando Torres for the game against Swindon. Which is away at the County Ground. That's quite exciting, isn't it? So what pressure's on those players? Can they perform? They're getting their opportunity. Spurs won at Cardiff. That's a terrific result. Are they the first team to win there all season, Sean?
Yeah, but they've only have played three games in the league. So.
Well, it was an impressive performance. So from what, and I only saw highlights, but...
They were good highlights.
A lot of attacking from Tottenham. They're apparently 29 shots, which is a season high in the Premier League. Not just good that they attacked with such kind of vigour, but that they kept on doing so until Fergie time, really. And the reason teams win over the course of a season, and the reason that teams that tend to win titles score lots of late goals, is that they believe they can and they kind of have the motivation to do so.
Right. So that's what Spurs have got. Here's another thing they've got, which I was really surprised about. 8 games so far, 7 clean sheets. Huh?
They'd have to be genuine title contenders, you'd think, wouldn't they?
Manchester
United, obviously, on a wobble. I don't think Chelsea are going to do anything this season. So.
There was this great line by Eric Torsvet, wasn't there? At
half time said, in the Europa League. No?
Yeah, absolutely.
We sold Elvis, but we bought the Beatles.
Yeah,
yeah. It was the line of the season, basically.
And it was the Beatles that won it. In the case, because it's Lamela and this magnificent piece of improvisation by Paulinho. It was superb. And I mean, you talked about the 29 shots and something like that. And Marshall had an astounding game in the Cardiff goal. Mm. So, yes. Who would have said that perhaps we're going to look back at Arsenal's victory over Spurs at the Emirates perhaps as one of the defining moments of the season, if things carry on as they are at the moment?
Mm.
Nobody would have predicted that, would they?
That's the funny thing about season-defining moments. You don't always know at the time that they are. But interesting. We'll keep an eye on that. Arsenal then, speaking of 7 in 8, that's 7 goals for Aaron Ramsey in 8 shots. Or it might be 9. Opinion is divided. But certainly 7 goals in 8 games now for Aaron
Ramsey. I thought it was quite interesting the way they stoked Stoke. Ooh. With
set pieces, with
the set piece goals, with follow a loose ball from a free kick and a couple of headers from the defenders coming forward. I was just waiting for Serge Gnabry to unveil his missile like long throws.
Mm.
Didn't quite happen. But
we really are not in Kansas anymore as regards the Premier League. No, Arsenal up on top, and all sorts of
we're over the rainbow.
Mm, very much so. Okay, Swansea beat Crystal Palace. Terrific result for them. A lot of people thought they might be struggling after their trip to Valencia in the Europa League, post-European fallout and that, but not a bit of it. And Ian Holloway's problems continue at Selhurst Park. In a second or two, we'll dial up Sid, perhaps, and get his reaction to events in the Liga this weekend. Bale with an injury, but also what the Spanish made of Valencia getting that drubbing from a team at the wrong end of the Premier League.
Hello, Jimbo.
Hi. You sound allegro.
Allegro.
Mm.
As opposed to Allegri, who upbeat. I believe was a football manager.
You sound upbeat, Sid.
I do.
Where do we find you today?
You find me at home, sitting in front of a computer, trying to finish off writing something about Valencia.
Brilliant. Okay. Valencia, how very, very relevant, because we were just talking about Swansea, and their terrific result last week against Valencia away there at Mestalla. And as one commentator put it, and I know you picked up on this, a real triumph for British football.
Yeah, six Spaniards in the Swansea starting lineup, four in the Valencia starting lineup. I thought Swansea were brilliant, and also not only that, of course, but then you add to that the Guzman, who played in Spain. You add to that Michael Laudrup, who of course is always seen as almost kind of belonging here. He's one of the few people that bridges the gap between Madrid and Barcelona, and is well liked on both sides of the divide. And I thought Swansea were brilliant, really, really good. Of course, it kind of goes hand in hand with an early red card for Valencia. It goes hand in hand with Valencia's crisis, which is why I'm writing about them, because last night they kind of rescued themselves from that crisis a little bit, and there was they were basically in line to sack the manager, but I think he will now continue to the end of the season, or at least he will if the president is true to his word. But despite those things, I still thought that Swansea were really very, very good indeed.
Right, excellent stuff. So Valencia still in the top half of the table, where Barcelona, Atletico Madrid sharing the lead on 15 points, with Real moving up into third place, 2 points behind. And Barcelona, a lot of people commenting on the fact that for the first time in 5 years, this weekend against Rayo Vallecano, was it? Three years, is it?
I think it's three years.
No, 5 years. Five years. Since the 4-1 defeat against Real Madrid in 2008, which was in,
right,
I think, March or April of 2008.
Right. The first time in 5 years that they didn't enjoy at least 50% of possession. And coming off the back of a very interesting interview that, or possibly not that interesting interview, but anyway, interview that Piqué gave to the Gazzetta in Italy, where he said that...
Well, to the Gazzetta in Spain, yeah, to Filippo Ricci here in Spain.
Yeah, for the Gazzetta, yeah.
Yeah.
In Italy, in which he said that basically, well, it was billed as being, you know, tiki-taka is dead, and that the club had to move on from that whole style, that whole philosophy.
That interview really didn't go down very well with some people in Catalonia. But as Filippo himself would tell you, I think people have kind of interpreted it as being a little bit more dramatic than it really was. And I thought Piqué made a very good point, which was that to some extent Barcelona had allowed themselves to believe that philosophy and the way they were playing was the absolute be-all and end-all, that there was just no way of questioning it at all. And his point wasn't so much, we should throw this out, this is no longer valid. It was more that, OK, if we have to mix it up on occasions, then so be it. There's no real problem with that. And it was interesting watching them this weekend because, you know, I'm reluctant to read too much into a goalkeeper's performance, but first of all, Victor Valdes made two or three brilliant saves, including one of them from a penalty. But the thing that was most striking, I thought, about Victor Valdes was when he got the ball, he was launching it long virtually every time, and Barcelona used that long ball an awful lot. Partly, I think, because the pitch was bad and they decided to be relatively pragmatic and say, against a team that pressures us really high on a pitch that's pretty ropey, that's tight, let's risk at the back. The other thing, of course, is that they had, and I don't mean this to sound as cruel as it's probably about to sound, but the other thing is that they had Alex Song in midfield, not Sergio Busquets. And I think that contributes to them not having as much of the ball because they're very different players. And Song, I think, positionally has been really quite bad for Barcelona. I think he's got some things to going for him, but positionally it hasn't really worked. He doesn't really fit that style. And yet Barcelona won 4-0, so I suppose you could argue that maybe that little bit of mixing up wasn't necessarily a bad thing, not in this game.
Right, OK. Has there been a lot of reaction to that story about Messi and his can of Coke?
It's a Swedish coach, isn't it, I think, who said this story, that Messi had basically been told that, you know, you don't have fizzy drinks on match days, and he opens his can of Coke and drinks it right in front of Pep Guardiola as this kind of open defiance, if you like, of Guardiola's rules.
Yeah, now, they're in a team talk. Guardiola, he says, yeah. I want a can of Coke. Guardiola says, you're not having a can of Coke. Messi goes, walks out of the room, comes back with a can of Coke, opens it and drinks it in front of Guardiola. All of which is quite interesting because he's actually sponsored by Pepsi, But it does kind of cost.
Well, we don't know if it wasn't a can of Pepsi. And this, by the way, follows up. There was a story, one of many stories about Jose Mourinho at Real Madrid, written by the El País journalist Diego Torres, who, by the way, is bringing out a Mourinho book in the next 3 or 4 weeks, I think, in England, about how it went wrong at Real Madrid. And one of his stories was about Mourinho getting stroppy and throwing a can of Red Bull around. So we've now got two cans of drinks being the symbol, if you like, of the internal problems of Madrid and Barcelona. One's a can of Red Bull, which Diego Torres described as tasting like fruits of the forest. And I had a word with him the other day and said, what are you talking about, fruits of the forest? It tastes like boiled sweets. But anyway.
Proper journalism, Sid. But as soon as we get a lemon-based beverage in there, we can talk about it being a fantastic reporting. But in the meantime, and on that very low note, let's move on to Real Madrid and Gareth Bale getting his slight muscle tear, slight strain?
Yeah, Madrid have described it as a sobrecarga. A sobrecarga really just means an overworking of the muscle, a strain. Right. I suppose you could call it a fatigue of the muscle, which means no tear. At least that's what I thought. But Jamie Scowcroft, who of course used to play for Ipswich, I believe, made a point earlier.
So he would know.
Any kind of strain normally involves a tear of some sort, even if it's very, very minor. Ancelotti said last night that he thought it was very difficult to see Bale being fit for the game on Wednesday night at Elche, but that he should be available for the weekend, Saturday night, Real Madrid play Atletico Madrid at the Bernabeu. So his home debut could well be that. The other thing that Ancelotti said, I mean, I asked the question last night, I said, you know, to what extent might this be partly a product of a pre-season, which Bale hasn't really had. You know, he hasn't really trained with Spurs. He only played, I think, one of Spurs' pre-season games. You know, he wasn't fully fit. And Ancelotti, quite interestingly, said, well, yeah, I think that's a key issue, not just physically, but also mentally, because, you know, he had to wait a long time for this all to happen. So I think there was perhaps a slight sense there from Ancelotti that kind of Bale needed to settle in, you know, not just in terms of being physically right, but also in terms of feeling comfortable about his surroundings.
Right. Okay, Sid, good stuff. In other news, Sid, Sevilla, oh my word, they're in real trouble, aren't they? That's one of the big names of Spanish football, and there they are in last place. Are they going down?
Beautifully done, Jimbo, because this brings us full circle to the start when we're talking about Valencia. Valencia were in trouble. It seemed like Jukic was going to be sacked. The team that was going to stick the knife into them was Sevilla, who, of course, are managed by Unai Emery. Unai Emery, the former Valencia manager, who was ditched because finishing third 3 years in a row wasn't good enough. And since then, they're not very good. Yeah. But they're in big trouble, Sevilla. I think I saw a statistic that said it was the worst start to a season for Sevilla in 55 years in 2 days' time. In fact, no, 1 day's time, because I must confess I saw the statistic last night, so it will be a day on. In 1 day's time, Sevilla will complete a calendar year without winning away from home.
Wow.
But they won't go down, by the way, because it's worth pointing out that this start is terrible. But look at who they've played. I might get this slightly wrong, but I think it's Real Sociedad, Malaga, Barcelona, Valencia, and the one other I think is Levante, which, all right, isn't much cop, but four of their five games have been really big ones. So I guess in that sense, it's probably not, perhaps not quite as bad as it looks. And I think they'll be all right.
All right, brilliant stuff.
Very quick question, hi Sid. I just wanted to ask you what was made of the Mata affair in Spain.
Oh, yeah, good show. Yeah.
So it really has captured the imagination here. As you can imagine, the nature of the way that things unraveled at the end with Mourinho and the way that his relationship was with a lot of the Spanish media, not all of it, but a big chunk of it by the end, they're quite enjoying Chelsea not being very successful. And you know, there's been a lot of talk of things going horribly wrong for Mourinho, and a lot of talk of it, you know, quite a lot of it, as I say, has been quite enjoyed by the Spanish media. And the other part of that is the focus on Mata. And there is an assumption that basically he doesn't like Mata because Mata's Spanish. And so there is this belief that somehow Mourinho is doing something really, really terrible here, driven by the rancor that he feels about Spanish players. Now, that obviously is backed up as well by the fact that Azpilicueta's not playing very much, that Fernando Torres is not playing very much. And I think, tactically, in terms of the type of football he's trying to play, I think Mourinho's decision can be justified, although obviously on a purely basic level, which is Juan Mata's really very, very good, then of course it's questionable.
Mm. Yeah. All right, nicely
and
done.
And obviously, you know, on a kind of a personal level, I can't believe you're messing with Mata. But yeah. There we go.
Yeah. Jose Mourinho is the anti-matter, isn't he?
Yes.
Danger.
Yeah, metaphysics, metapsychosis.
Yeah. Sid, brilliant stuff. Many thanks. Look forward to speaking to you soon.
Okay, speak to you on Thursday. Cheers.
Cheers, Sid. In France, Monaco weathered the storm, in a manner of speaking, that 1-1 draw in El Clasico at the Parc des Princes. €500 million spent on these two teams, and it didn't produce that much, did it? I mean, nice early goal from Ibra.
Very nice early goal. Typical dive. Zlatan with a kind of volley with the studs.
And equally typical was the way he wasted at least three golden opportunities to take the win by being a bit fancy, Dan.
A bit fancy, I mean, he was still Paris Saint-Germain's best player.
Would you say?
Yeah, I would say so.
I would have thought there'd be a lot of frustration with him after that performance.
There were other players were just as frustrating and not frustrating. It was not exactly as wonderful as some were expecting. This said, it brought, I think, conclusive evidence that Monaco had still a lot of work to do, particularly defensively. They looked very shaky. But it was not the all singing, all dancing performance that people were expecting, which is a pity because we had loads of goals in action during the afternoon, you know, at Nice, and we had a 3-3 as well. And we're thinking
Nice
maybe
in their new stadium, the Allianz Riviera.
Yeah, the Allianz Riviera. You'll get to get used to that. 4-0 they won.
Mm, they did.
But it was not exactly the greatest of spectacles. It was not bad.
It was all right.
In presence of our friends Nicolas Sarkozy and Sheikh Tamim, ruler of Qatar.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Excellent.
Old friends,
eh? Yeah. Interesting, Philippe. We might touch on that again in a second or two. But in the meantime, Monaco stay on top with Paris Saint-Germain now second. In Turkey, it all kicked off at the end of the Istanbul derby between Beşiktaş and Galatasaray. Galatasaray were leading 2-1 in the 93rd minute. Drogba had scored a brace. Felipe Melo got a red card for some horror tackle. I think it was, or it might have been two yellows. I'm not sure. I didn't see the game. But at this point, as he left the field, apparently waving his Galatasaray shirt over his head, the Beşiktaş fans decided enough was enough and stormed the pitch. And then everything, it all went a bit loopy and the referee had to suspend the match. And there's some suggestion that Beşiktaş fans, who I believe were very actively involved or have been very actively involved in the ongoing kind of political protest against the government there, were actually doing something that was more to do with politics, but it certainly looked quite football-based.
Were any of the players hurt?
No, they just scarpered pronto. Yeah. But anyway, very regrettable scenes there. Italy, my word, what a weekend in Italy. You see any of this, Sean?
I did, and I can't believe Roma are top.
Can you not?
Well, given the players they've sold, given Totti's a year older, the fact that, what's it, the 10 goal difference of 10 and 1.
I don't know, it's just remarkable, isn't it? Rudy Garcia, what a manager he is.
Yeah, the man who was, when he arrived at Roma, even before he had, I think, set foot in the training ground, people were having a go at him.
Mm. They looked rather stupid. A message to him, didn't they? Rudy. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, wow. The thing which is remarkable is that he also, he has some courage, that man, because he, I think just before the game, he said that Derby is not
a game to play, it's a game to win.
You win.
Yeah. And they certainly
which
did.
Is putting him some pressure on himself.
Again, it wasn't the greatest of games, this. Yeah. Usually you have that terrific pre-game spectacle when one Cordova will put up a message insulting the other side, and the other side will respond because they've had spies telling them what they were going to have. But this time, unfortunately, for the Lazio fans, they had a Coppa Italia because they had a 1-0 win in the Coppa Italia final against Roma the last time they faced each other in May. And they were going to have this basically ascend to the heavens hoisted by balloons, but there was a health and safety issue and they were banned from doing it. So with their noses put out of joint, they decided not to attend the opening of the game and instead came in about 2 or 3 minutes in. They all started piling in. So it was a bizarre sight with the kind of the one quarter of it empty at the start. And then, Balzaretti scored and burst into tears. Such was the emotion of the moment. And Ljajic with the penalty that made it 2-0. And that was that game. The big story, though, was up at the San Siro, where struggling Milan earned Barry a penny or two by losing at home to Napoli. Now, down in Naples, things are going a bit bonkers at the moment. You had the win against Dortmund on Wednesday, now this. And, you know, people are saying, not since the days of Maradona have we beaten a German side in Europe. Not since the days of Maradona have we been alone on top of the table, which they were last week. Not since the days of Maradona have we gone to the San Siro and won. And they did. And everyone getting very excited about what Rafa Benitez is doing there.
It's great, though. I mean, the reason I bet on Napoli, they were 2-1. And I was just so appalled by the Milan I saw against Celtic during the week. It's the worst Milan team I've ever seen in my life. Like a pub team. They were just astonishingly
bad.
Well,
it looks like things are going to get even worse for them because, well, they lost 2-1. They were in this game, even though the scoreline was against them, right the way through. And Balotelli had the chance to really put them back in it when he had a penalty. But dramatically, as you probably saw, he missed the penalty.
First time ever, apparently.
Yeah, 22nd penalty he's taken. And Pepe Reina, who apparently has studied his penalty-taking technique at length, sussed out the fact that he goes one way if the keeper moves and another way if the keeper doesn't move. It's near post if the keeper doesn't move. And so he didn't move and went near post and he blocked the shot. And Balotelli, who claims that he had... Well, Balotelli was upset. He felt he had at least one other penalty in the course of the game. And thus, at the end of the match, earned himself a red card by going up to the officials and basically doing a Balotelli. He just wouldn't let them alone. He took off his shirt. He was standing there bare-chested with his arms behind his back and his pecs flexed in the officials' faces and trying to get at them. And then the referee shows him a red card for being annoying because he was there for 2 or 3 minutes. And then his co-players are trying to get him out of there and he won't go. You know, he breaks away and runs back towards the officials. Very regrettable. So he'll be missing next time out. And my word, Milan with all sorts of problems. Once again, Rafa Benitez, bit of a Milan nightmare. Anyway, beyond all of that, you've got a little bit of a centre-south revolution, as the papers describe it, with Napoli and Roma on top, the only two teams with perfect records. But five teams, let me just check how many points between them. Five teams, Roma, Napoli, Inter, Fiorentina and Juventus within the space of 2 points. It's very entertaining indeed. Inter, quick mention for them because two big events at that club. One, the fact that Moratti is no longer the owner of the club. It's now passed to the Indonesian magnate Erik Thohir, who owns 70% of the club and has paid off some of their debts and stuff. But in the meantime, this weekend, they went down to Sassuolo and won 7-0. That's their biggest ever away win. Diego Milito marking his return with a brace, and he was in tears as well. The other big story...
I noticed that scoreline yesterday and I called to mind your assertion that Italian teams usually take their foot off the pedal after once they got 3-0 up. It didn't happen in that game.
But the other interesting thing about Inter is that I think they've scored 13 goals so far this season. All of them have been from open play. What does it mean? I don't know.
But is one of the reasons for that the fact that goal difference doesn't play a role in Serie A in determining...
I think it didn't used to. And here people are going to write in and tell me I'm wrong. I think it didn't used to. I think it used to be head-to-head.
I think it does now. I thought it was still
head-to-head. They keep changing things, and excuse my ignorance. It's a very good question, Philly. There was also, behind that, there was also a feeling that you don't kick a man when he's down. You don't insult your fellow professional by taking advantage when things have gone very wrong. But, you know, 3-0 down can easily come to 3-3 back. So generally, I think they waited till they were 4 or 5 up. But not on this occasion. They kept going. The other thing to mention, and this was a big talking point last week, Fernando Llorente What's happened here? Where is the missing Fernando Llorente? The Spanish press talking about it, Italian press talking about it. Are Juve just going to sign him and never use him like Anelka and Bentner? Well, this weekend, Conte decided that he needed to freshen up the squad. He dropped Buffon, brought in Storari. He went with Llorente up front, and it was a big test for him. And he came through with flying colours, scored. They went behind to a goal from Cacciatore from Atalanta, but they came back and won 2-1 goals from Tevez and Llorente, and rave reviews for the Spaniards' performance in the papers. Right, that's a little Italian roundup. Let's finish off today with a quick nod to something you were just touching on there, and the whole Qatari influence, etc. This has been a massive story of late, Philippe, with Sepp Blatter now saying that there were political motives behind this is extraordinary stuff. Motives behind Qatar getting the World Cup. Basically, a suggestion that governments had urged their FAs to vote for Qatar to get the World Cup, which I don't think anyone's terribly surprised about. It was never going to be for footballing reasons that it went there, would it?
Well, I won't go down that way, but the thing, when you read the Code of Ethics and also you read the bid document for 2018 and especially 2022, you know, you will say that there's always political influence, and this is actually the way that Platini commented upon it, is that it's true. When you've got Prince William
flying... Platini, not Blatter, sorry.
No, but they both commented. Oh, okay. Blatter was the first one to suggest the fact that, yes, there was multiple inference from governments and direct pressure applied. And it's not an innocent remark at all, because if you look at the small print of the bid documents, it's very clear that it is out of the question for anybody to be the subject of such influence and to yield to it. And it's very precise. And there's a big difference between, you know, say, a celebrity, a dignitary meeting, you know, Mr. Cameron meeting Mr. Blatter at Downing Street, having a nice chat, and the person who is in charge of the country's bid saying, well, you'd rather, you know, vote, make sure they vote for me on otherwise. And the way it's going at the moment, I mean, this massive, huge mess, which is the result of the 2nd of December 2010 vote, and is suddenly coming up. It's rising to the top. It's now exploding in all directions.
Now, I've been asking a lot of people what they think. Is it going to be Qatar in the winter, Qatar in the summer, or somewhere else in the summer? And most people say, in fact, I think everyone so far has said, no, it'll be played in Qatar in the winter. And it seemed to be moving towards that again last week when Platini, or there was this announcement that the various European FAs had agreed in principle to discuss how to make it work with the Winter World Cup.
They haven't. That is a complete misrepresentation.
So what actually happened
in Dubrovnik? If you read what David Gill had to say about this, they said all we discussed was the fact that basically we couldn't play in the summer, and that the option of moving to winter had to be studied, and there had to be a process of negotiation.
So they are willing to study it,
but of course, if you've got your medical officers, first of all, there was the report for 2010 that said it was a high risk dossier because of the heat in the summer, then you've got your medical responsible, Mr. Dog, the Belgian, who also says it's impossible. When you've got Mr. Mayne Nichols, who was in charge of the expert committee of FIFA, the former head of the Chilean League and FA, who says we can't have that, it has to be in the winter. The evidence is mounting and mounting for something we all knew, is that it's not a particularly good idea, so you have to move it. So in principle, you say, well, we cannot play in the summer, but we cannot play in the summer doesn't mean we'll play it in the winter. And I'm amazed that people don't think that one necessarily means the other. We're at an extraordinarily tense moment within the relationship within FIFA, with the presidential elections coming in 2015, with Mr. Sepp Blatter probably representing himself at the election, Michel Platini not knowing exactly where his destiny lies, as he puts it, and Qatar has become this hot potato between the two men, and so hot potato, very hot potato.
So Sepp Blatter is now anti-Qatar and Platini is pro-Qatar, is that the way it breaks down?
Sepp Blatter has never been in favour of Qatar. Right. It is, I wouldn't say well documented, but I think everybody would agree that Sepp Blatter supported he had a soft spot for the Australian bid, but especially for the American bid.
Right. And what do you think is going to happen?
Whereas Platini has been very clear, and at least he's had at least the courage to be in the open, unlike some others, to say that he was in favour of Qatar.
What do you think is going to happen, Philippe, in 2022?
We are at present in an insolvable situation, as in none of the alternatives seems to be working. The summer, the medical people say it's not possible.
Yep.
Even though the Qataris now insist it is possible.
Yeah, but...
And the winter, is also not possible for other reasons which
so
have to do with...
So, wintering Qatar or somewhere else entirely, what's going to happen?
I wouldn't take any bet on that, anyway. No, I wouldn't take any bet. I think it is completely fluid, and at the moment, I don't think that any, on the record, I don't think that any possibility should be excluded.
You think it's possible there could be no World Cup in 2022?
I think it's possible that pretty dramatic choices are made, yes.
Right, in terms of schisms in world football.
Well, I'm fearing that. You know, what's going to... I mean, at the moment, it's a head-on clash between UEFA and FIFA.
Right.
You've got a head-on clash between FIFA, some elements, and the PFL. You've got Karl-Heinz Rummenigge talking out of his hat, saying that he's representing ECA and making comments about it's got to be moved to winter when there has been absolutely no vote within the ECA. So you've got all these people who are going, well, clashing against each other, which is why I'm saying it's very difficult to tell what is going to be left. Something will happen, but honestly, to come up today and say this is going to happen, it's going to be played in the winter, it's not going to be played in Qatar, it's not going to be played in summer, I think would be, to say the least, irrational.
That you disappoint me, Philippe. That's exactly what I wanted you to do.
Never mind.
All right.
Well, okay, it's an absolute mess.
It is a mess. Okay.
And if it ain't, it'll do till the mess gets here.
Yeah. Indeed so. Indeed so. Many, many thanks then, Philippe. And I think that brings us to the end of today's broad-ranging Football Weekly. We didn't even talk about Watford, Simon.
A terrible shame.
5-1.
5-1, yeah. 5-1 at Barnsley. Though, to be fair, nearly everyone beats Barnsley 5-1.
That's true.
It's the third time this season they've conceded five,
really?
And there's been a four. So not going so well for them tykes.
No, indeed not. But how Watford thumbs up?
Watford's doing fine. QPR... looking ominous. Keep in that championship. They just keep winning 1-0. They've scored terribly few goals. I think only four teams have scored fewer.
They've scored 8 goals in 8 games.
Their goal to point conversion rate is pretty amazing. I think the last 5 wins have all been 1-0.
Well, it's very exciting on top of the championship. You've got 1, 2, 3 teams on 70 points. Burnley, Leicester and Blackpool. QPR 3 points above them. But very, very much early days. Anyway, Philippe.
Just, we should mention Jorge Jesus, perhaps, his extraordinary intervention.
Why, what did he do?
During the Guimarães-Benfica game, which Benfica won 1-0.
What happened?
Some Benfica fans made the stage a small pitch invasion. Ooh. The police intervened, and Jesus leapt from his technical zone to help his own fans not being taken by the police. I can't remember a manager doing that, basically coming to the help of his own fans who were a little bit rough-handled by the police. I think that his image and status with the Benfica fans is quite high at the moment.
Yeah, he owes them after the failures at the end of last season. They lost the league at the death, and they lost the Europa League.
They lost everything
at the death, and the Portuguese Cup at the death.
That's a
good perspective, Barry. Excellent. All right. On that Lusitanian note, we will conclude today's show. Many thanks, Sean Ingle.
Thank you.
And guest producer Ian Barry, Philippe and Simon Burnton, and you, listener. We'll be back with a special post-League Cup show on Thursday. Do join us for that.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life online. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today with no credit card required. And as a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 20% off in September by using the offer code Guardian. Squarespace. Everything you need to create an exceptional website.